The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Good morning. So today we celebrate the birth of the Buddha. And as you all know, he was born 2,500 years plus ago in Lumbini in India. So a long time ago, far away from America. But here we are, 2,500 years plus from that time. And we're here this Sunday celebrating the Buddha's birth. And I think that's kind of points to the remarkableness of his teaching and how it really helps human beings, and human beings are attracted to it. So what I thought I'd talk about today is what I'll call the hopeful opportunity that we have being born into this world as human beings. Because, in Buddhism, we believe you could be born in other places, and obviously you could be born in this world in other as other things than human beings. There's a lot of other things in this world, but we all in this room have been born as human beings. Although I think sometimes the human condition is something that we find very difficult, but we are born as human beings. So as you know, the Buddha was not a god. He's just a human being like you and me. I think that he was extraordinary, remarkable person, but he was a human being. And I think that's something we want to always remind ourselves of about him and his teachings. This is a human being offering teaching to human beings. His mother, Queen Maya, died the week after his birth. And for myself, I've often thought that the fact that his mother died shortly after his birth, that probably catapulted him into his search for the reason of human suffering. I mean, no matter what age you are, when your mother dies, it's difficult. Even if you didn't like your mother, maybe, it's still difficult. And this is the person you came through into this world. My mother died when I was 33 years old, 10 years as a monk. I grieved over her death for a long time. It was in the winter. She died in the end of March. And I would walk around the rest of the winter and look at the trees that had no, leaves on them in particular. And the thought would come to my mind, well, that's going to die someday. And I the bell toll of impermanence just really rung in my ears. Okay. I felt fortunate after her death to realize that although I would grieve, this did not have to be suffering. It just was grieving. It's just natural that we grieve. If you know about the Buddha's life, he lived, it appears, a very sheltered life in his younger years. Impermanence seems to have been hidden from him, although I don't quite see how you could do that all. But his father was making this great effort to keep him in the palace and to give him this rosy picture of life and sensuality and all these pleasures. And because when the Buddha was born, it was predicted that either he would be a great monarch or he would be a great Buddha. Okay? And his father wanted him to be a great monarch. He wasn't keen on him being the Buddha. I mean, in a sense, that changed later on, but okay. So his father really sheltered him from impermanence. But as I say, how can you do that? You're just going to miss something. You know, that plant over there is just going to start wilting and dying, and you've got so many plants that you won't catch that one. But so, yeah, I think he had some kind of inkling, even in this sheltered life, that there was impermanence. And again, his mother died shortly after his birth. I think that left an impression. Even though I'm sure he was wonderfully, extravagantly taken care of, that left something. So he eventually, as you know, wanders into the local city, and he sees impermanence at work. And this is his first time in his life. It's just right in front of his face. He sees an old person, a sick person, and a corpse. And it's like, whoa. They're suffering. You know, there's impermanence. Things don't last forever. Fortunately, he also saw this wandering, dignified ascetic. He saw someone who was trying to make sense of all this in a spiritual way. And that kind of, you know, resonated with him as maybe there was another way to go about this thing called life, and also a way that would give him a way to look at things. So he leaves his comfortable palace and he sets off on the search for the truth. Why are things as they are? Why is there human suffering? In the course of doing this, he almost annihilates himself because he's really ascetic. You know, really is doing these terribly ascetic practices. Really emaciated, but he wasn't getting anywhere. Suffering was just still right there in his face, and no answer as to why was it this way, and what can I do about it? Okay, so he doesn't die, you know, good for us, and decides upon this more moderate course, remembering this experience that he had as a small child of just sitting still, and noticing his breath. He fell into meditation as a young child. Again, this was an extraordinary human being. I didn't think I did that much as a child. The Buddha lived to be 80 years old, which is, I think, in that point in time was probably pretty old, you know, over 2,500 years ago. I don't know that 80 would be an age most people would be living to, but he lived to 80. Okay. Again, he was this extraordinary human being. But because you put the what's it called, the adjective? Extraordinary there, it doesn't drop off the fact that he was a human being. Look at this another way. Being human, and this included the Buddha, the one certainty that we all have is that we're going to die. Being born, somewhere along the line, we're going to die. If there is birth, there is death. Well, you know, I mean, the hope for all of us is that we live long and prosper. I think would they say that in Star Trek or something? But that we, you know, that's the hope for human beings, because we'd like to see everybody be around, but we know it isn't that way. You know, you in your life or beyond your life, we know of people that have loss. I mean, people that have died at a young age. We know people that have died in tragic circumstances. So we really don't know how much time we have. I'm not trying to be morbid here, but we don't. We just don't know. I mean, every day is actually a gift. Okay. So that's a good reason to get on with it and find what the Buddha found. I mean, the bell of impermanence, the bell toll of impermanence is there. It's just there, you know. Sometimes it's more evident, and sometimes it's more in the background, but it's there. The Buddha found unconditioned peace of heart beyond birth and death. That's what he found. Okay. This didn't make impermanence go away, but this was a real insight, you know, a deep insight to something that both accepts impermanence and transcends it. All his teachings point to this place. For me, the wonderful thing about the Buddha's teachings is that both that we can find this place, okay, every person can find this place, and that we must find it ourselves. In the beginning, I really liked that because I just didn't. In the 60s, in the late 60s, I lived near Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, and I'd go to these various talks by gurus and teachers and people that had a month's experience of something. And as soon as they get kind of glassy-eyed and, you know, it's like they could do it for you or that something could do it for you outside of yourself, I was out of there because I just didn't think it worked, you know. I mean, it's not that you can't be helped. You can. And we're not alone because we're interdependent. We're so much the same. But we have to do the work ourselves. And as I say, each one of us has that ability. It's said in Buddhism that the human realm is the best place to be born. It's the best place to awaken to a place of peace, compassion, wisdom, and joy. The human realm. Okay? You can do other realms. Some of them are big suffering. Some of them are so pleasurable that you don't notice. One of the reasons that that the human realm is the best place to awaken is because the tick-tock of impermanence is there, moment by moment. You know, the evidence of impermanence, it's all around us. We have only to look. If we look and accept impermanence as a mark of existence, as part of our existence, in time we begin to see how it could not be any other way, and that this is okay. And there's nothing to be afraid of in this. It's just the way it is. If we meditate within the flow of impermanence, we see a deeper place, a place that both accepts and transcends impermanence. So this is what the Buddha found, that place that accepts and transcends impermanence. In the Pali Canon, which is a lot of the teachings that the Buddha gave, recorded and passed on, there's a section of the Pali Canon called the Udana Discourses, and Udana translates as verses of uplift. Okay, so in one of these verses, he said, "Monks, there is a not born, a not become, a not made, a not compounded. Monks, if that unborn, not become, not made, not compounded were not, there would be apparent no escape from this here that is born, become, made, compounded. But since, monks, there is an unborn, not become, not made, not compounded, therefore the escape from this here that is born, become, made, compounded is apparent." He also says in the Udana Discourses, "One who is dependent has wavering. One who is independent has no wavering. There being no wavering, there is calm. There being calm, there is no desire or inclination. There being no desire or inclination, there is no coming or going. There being no coming or going, there is no passing away or arising. There is neither a here nor a there, nor a between the two. This, just this, is the end of dukkha, the end of suffering." It's said that what the Buddha taught can be distilled down to two points. So, he taught suffering and the end of suffering. He never just taught suffering. People will say that about Buddhism who don't know anything about it. They say, "Oh, you people just have all this suffering stuff all the time." And he never just taught suffering. But you know, he was realistic. He knew that people were suffering. He himself had suffered deeply. So he taught about suffering and the cessation of suffering. Last Sunday, Burmester Mann talked about how we can either accept things as they are, or we can put up a battle of non-acceptance and suffer. So either we can accept or we can suffer. Human life as we know it is not always easy. Sometimes the people think about the Buddha and say, well, this was this enlightened being. You know, it was kind of easy for him, wasn't it? You know, he just kind of floated along. Well, read the history of the Buddha if you want to. It was not easy. You know, he had people that slandered him. He had people that tried to kill him. And on occasion, he would have his teaching just basically tossed back in his face. There's this incident in Kosambi. So the monks were there. I think it was the beginning of the rains retreat. So they were there in Kosambi at a meditation place, and you had to stay there. The idea in the rainy season is that you didn't move around. There's this argument between the monks that are kind of authorities on the Dharma and monks that are authorities on the Vinaya. So there's, you know, the Dharma we know. The Vinaya is the rules that the monks have to govern their life. I personally don't know how you could have an argument between the two, but somehow they got into an argument about the two. And it was all over something with respect to a minor transgression in the lavatory. I mean, you know, it seems really pretty silly. But they were having this pretty heated argument, and the Buddha went and tried to help. You know, he said, "Can I help out?" And basically, he was told, "No, you can't. You're enlightened. You can't really help us." But that's what we do, you know. Sometimes, when the truth is right in front of our face, we just don't want to look at it. And so, what happened is the Buddha, on his own, just doesn't tell anybody, he heads out, and he heads to the jungle, and he meets an elephant and a monkey there, who, at least the elephant had the same predicament with the herd of elephants that the elephant was living with, so there was this real alliance, and they took care of the Buddha, there, as the story goes. But meanwhile, back at the meditation place where the monks were, the lay people wouldn't feed them, because they heard what happened and what they did to the Buddha. And so this kind of brings the monks, you know, down a peg or two, and they realize, geez, you know, we ought to apologize. So they send Ananda off to the jungle to bring the Buddha back. And he comes back. And then he tells him, you know, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't do this. And so his life was not always easy. I think that's important to remember, because we can have this thing about people who make spiritual progress and say, well, they have these special qualities. It's baloney, you know. They're just putting effort in, and above all, they just keep getting up and keep up the practice. So the Buddha knew disappointment. He knew sadness. His two chief disciples, Shariputra and Moggallana, died before he died. And it was really sad for him. You know? But he also said, this is the way things are. This is how they happen. I think he would have preferred to have died before them, but he didn't. You know, he was sad. The Buddha had physical pain. I think at one point when somebody tried to throw this enormous boulder at him when he was out wandering to, I think basically kill him anywhere, somehow a piece of it falls off and it hits his foot, and he ended up with foot problems for the rest of his life. In his older years, he had back problems, he had headaches. One day, Ananda, his attendant, was massaging his back, probably because his back hurt, and Ananda took a look at the Buddha, and he was kind of like, he realized the Buddha was getting old. And the Buddha basically said, "Well, what do you expect? I'm 80 years old, getting old." So, you know, And he had headaches. He, you know, I'm sure he had many other things too. And he didn't die. His death was painful. So with a human body and human feelings, we're going to have some pain in life. There will be sickness. I mean, it's very rare that somebody goes all the way to death without sickness in between. But, you know, some people get close, and good for them. But most of us are going to get sick. Things are going to happen, okay? And eventually we're going to die. Beings and things that we cherish and love will also die. Things compounded will uncompound. They'll come apart. Even the most substantial thing that we view, if you really look at it, you know that in time it uncompounds. There will be sadness and grief and pain in our lives. Buddhism does not say that's not going to happen. You know, I think that's false hope to say you're not going to experience those. But sadness, grief, and pain are one thing. They actually don't have to go to the point of suffering. Okay? So as Reverend Master Mann was saying, you know, you can either accept or you can suffer. Pain happens, but the suffering part is actually optional. Okay? It's what we tag on to those things, to those things that happen to us in life, those disappointments, those feelings, those hurts, whatever. But it's what we tag on to those that takes them to the point of suffering, or doesn't, because we can bear them and let them go. Okay, and I know this is really easy to say, because it is easy to say. The truth is, though, that things are what we make of them. It's not about the people who have all the great opportunities and all the abilities and everything goes right for them and it's all wonderful. It's about the people that make something out of what? Make something out of their life. So there are all these opportunities in our daily life to view things this way or that way. It just over and over again. And we can see it this way, we can see it that way. You know, it's this perspective thing. If we are honest with ourselves, the cause of frustration and suffering lies in the fact that we hold on to things, grasp after them, and get attached to them. But as we know from a deeper place, thinking and acting in this way flies in the face of the fact of impermanence. We cannot stop impermanence. But we can change how we relate to it. We can let go of trying to halt and fix everything. It doesn't work. And accept life as it is. Now, realistically, I don't think you or I will be the next acknowledged, awakened Buddha. I mean, we're just human beings. People like the Buddha are rare. We can, though, for ourselves, realize and put into practice the truth that the Buddha taught. Because if we look with care, he simply taught things as they are. There's a straightforwardness about the teachings of the Buddha. And some things he wouldn't even talk about. He said it just doesn't lead to edification. And as I said before, the Buddha said, you must find these things true for yourself. I think that's a wonderful aspect of Buddhism. You have to get in there and do the work and look at things and figure it out. If we do that with an open heart, you know, in a generous way, there's all these things to help us. So, you know, I actually feel don't have a whole lot to say in this whole talk. In a way, it's like I'm just encouraging everybody. Okay? I've been told that I teach like a coach because that's what I spent most of my younger life playing team sports, athletics. And I had a whole variety of coaches, and some were, incredible people, but that's okay. I don't mind being given that. People say, actually my teacher said that, and that's fine. Because I think it's important to encourage us all, because it's difficult sometimes. But I firmly believe that nirvana can be found in this lifetime by us just human beings. It wasn't just for the Buddha. It isn't just for the time after this. It's in this lifetime for all of us who want to make the effort. And I want to emphasize on this day of the celebration of the Buddha's birth that we all have the same opportunity as the Buddha. We can find compassion, wisdom, and peace of heart in this life. We will find that by continuing our practice through our life, through all its ups and downs, it'll just grow. It'll grow. And it'll be there for us. If we make the precepts our blood and bones, compassion and wisdom will manifest quite naturally in our daily lives. It isn't like we have to do something to be wise and be this special person to be compassionate. Keep the precepts. Keep your eyes open. And, if you make that effort, it will arise quite naturally in your daily life. For every big thing that happens in our lives, there are 100,000 little moments. We can't just be looking for the big things. Compassion and wisdom are not just about the big things. They're actually about those 100,000 little moments that are constantly appearing. And they're appearing for us, not for these special people, but for us. We need to awaken to these little moments. We need to pay attention and turn our hearts in a way that we can benefit all beings. Buddhist practice takes real energy, and there are definitely trying moments. I mean, we say in Buddhism that patience is the greatest austerity. And there's all these ascetic practices that you can do, but actually just being patient is the most difficult and the most fruitful, too. What I found doesn't work for me with the trials and tribulations of life is to make life into more of a struggle than it needs to be. Okay? We just don't have to make it harder than it is. Okay? And if we don't do that, if we're more light of heart, then it lightens the load for the heart. It lightens the load just for us in our training. And we'll get through it. No matter what it is, we'll get through it. Looking up. Implicit in the acceptance of suffering is the transcendence of suffering. And following this way, human life, this great opportunity to do something with our life, becomes more joyous. Because the training is actually joyous. So thank you.